Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota on Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.
The choir loft is the second floor balcony, the organ is a Wurlitzer, and popcorn is the sacrament. Thank you for joining us once again. My name is Jack Bennett, putting on this little bit of vaudeville every week with my dad, Christian author Rod Bennett. If you've been following along, we're in the fifth and final week of a series on Raiders of the Lost Ark, looking at the movie from perspective of believing Christians. We've seen how the indie character came to be, how his story almost got sidetracked into a cheesy episode of Ancient Aliens, and how the real Ark of the Covenant figures into the tale. We're going to finish up this week by trying to learn how and when Von Däniken's electrical Ark got pushed out by the biblical Ark, and why it made future Indiana Jones flicks so difficult to make. Anyhow, Dad is calling this week this week's episode, Why Indy Won't Convert. Let's dig right in.
All right, thank you for that nice introduction, Jack. I think Jack's doing a great job, don't you guys?
I don't know about that.
Also, I need to do a hand clap or two for you guys, our audience. We're pushing 6 hours on one movie here. You probably cheered when you heard that this was the last episode.
I don't know.
But yes, you're a pretty good audience already if you'll stick around for 6 hours on one movie.
Yep.
And 6 hours of my voice. Now, that is a challenge.
All right, here we go.
But anyway, this should be fun. This will be the final episode where we'll draw all these threads together, looking at how everything we've talked about up to this point affected Indiana Jones, the character, and also the future of his series. So we tried to confine most of what we've been talking about to the original Raiders of the Lost Ark. The other movies will come in a little bit in this one, but I think you'll probably see by the end why we haven't gone deeply into them. Maybe we'll talk, after you guys have had a nice break from Indy, maybe we'll talk about those other movies in a bit more depth at some time in the future. So if we haven't run you off by the end of this episode.
If we're still around by then, provided, of course.
Okay. So anyway, this one should be interesting. Like I say, we called this one Why Indy Won't Convert. So without further ado, this also will be a little bit more free form. You've been listening to a lot of scripted stuff up to now.
Just last week we had an outright church service pretty much here on the Popcorn Cathedral, on TPC.
there you go. And that was because I had such a large quantity of material to just power through. So we did it with the script. So, but this one will be maybe a little bit more freeform and just a little bit of Jack and I hanging out with you guys sitting in. So anyway, here we go. You probably remember one of Indy's final lines in Raiders of the Lost Ark is where he's coming down the steps at the government building and he says, "Bureaucratic fools, they don't realize what they've got there." I think this is a pretty good line.
A really interesting line to me. It's always been, I've wondered constantly about this.
Well, while I admire all of the Indiana Jones filmmakers very much, and I certainly wouldn't call them fools, I think this line probably goes a long way toward explaining most of the major defects in the series going forward. because I don't think the filmmakers realized what they had by the end of the movie, by the time the movie was finished. And I'm not sure they ever got a real firm grasp on it.
Yeah, they just didn't really ever nail everything about Indy and his story down as much as they needed to. I mean, it's...
Well, when they let the Ark of the Covenant in, at the last minute, as I think you're going to see, they let in a Trojan horse, and they created this crisis of Indy's conversion, and something that never has really been resolved successfully. But I think we can show you what we mean as we go forward.
So we're going back to the transcript here for a little bit.
For a minute or two. Yeah. In the original story conferences where George pitched his idea to Larry Kasdan and Steven Spielberg, Lucas had this to say about how the movie would end. And keep in mind, this is right at the beginning, not even a script yet. George says, "Our guys should be really skeptical about the powers of the Ark. But the arch rival, who doesn't even have a name yet at this point, is convinced that it's all true, that it has power. And with it, they could rule the world." They sort of trade myths and legends back and forth. Now, keep in mind, we're still dealing with Phil Kaufman's electrical arc concept at this stage, with the arc as an example of either Egyptian super science or else a von Däniken-style extraterrestrial artifact. So, let me go back to George for just a minute. "In the end," he says, "the bad guy was right, and our guy is there to see it. He doesn't see the electrical arcs and stuff, but he sees the tent go into a ball of fire."
Yeah.
When he gets back to Washington, he's telling the guys, "That arc, it's true, it's the lost arc. The Army guy tells him they'll take care of it. It's all top secret stuff." He gets shut out of it, and they don't believe him. They just put it away. And then a bit later, George says, "Cut to Washington. Our ending is the Ark crated up. No one even looks at it. They crate it up and put it in an Army warehouse somewhere. That's how it ends, very bureaucratic. The feeling is that the Ark is the real thing, that it really is a very powerful thing." And then Stephen, who's been listening to all of this, steps in with just one word: supernatural.
Very interesting.
Now, the most interesting aspect of this conversation is this leap that Steven Spielberg makes right at the end. Steven was very casual about his faith in those days. Not at all now.
That's, this would be in 1979 or 78. 78, yeah. Early on.
Yeah. And he underwent a real kind of reconversion to Judaism, or initial conversion to it, in response to the experiences connected with making Schindler's List years later. But anyway, even so, even though he was casual with his faith, he already sees where the real interest is in this idea. Basically, we've mashed a lot of things up with Spy Smasher and the Republic serials at this point. We've put in Mummy movies and Casablanca and all the other things. Stephen instinctively, I think, sees that we need to add one more 50s convention into this, and that is the Ten Commandments and the big 50s Bible movie, which Stephen was a fan of. In fact, Ten Commandments is one of his favorite films. But anyhow, George, on the other hand, as you can tell from the transcripts, he's not talking supernatural at all at this point. He's still talking about a powerful, mysterious machine.
Mechanical still.
Yes.
Here, you know.
And this is why even in the finished movie, we still have Marcus at the end telling the government men that the Ark needs to be researched.
It should be researched and studied.
You know?
I mean,
well,
Marcus at the end of the movie.
Wait a second. We're going to research it now? Even though Indy wouldn't even allow Marion to look at it while they were on the island?
I mean, are the government men right?
Maybe
they're right to put it away.
Well, like, there's that.
Doesn't Sala say, you know, "Indy, there is something that troubles me. The Ark, if it is there at Tanis, then it is something man was not meant to disturb. Death has always surrounded it. It is not of this earth."
Excellent. Good job. Jack, Jack should be credited there. He doesn't have a script in front of him, folks. He did that from memory.
Well, but the thing is, it's... I mean, the government man put it away with God only knows what else we see in the warehouse.
Right,
I mean, are they right? Maybe it is something that we're not meant to...
Well, that's it. That's an interesting point. Let's come back to that.
It, you know, I've always wondered this.
Yeah. A similar comment comes right in the middle of the Kaufman, Fine, Kasdan interview, where Phil is pitching his von Däniken arc pretty hard, and suddenly researcher Deborah Fine steps in and says, you know, the thing that struck me about the arc, what's fantastic about it is, if it were ever found, when you think about the significance of it in terms of making people believers, I mean, if the original tablets were ever found, there's a terrific symbolic thing about it. And after she said this,
the very tablets, not the ones, the replacement ones that Moses made, Moses and Aaron carved later. These are the ones,
if you believe the Talmud, both are in
there. Of course, yes. Oh, both sets. Okay, I'm forgetting here.
Right, right. But yes, she's seeing what the general public would see here, and that is that, gee whiz, if you ever found the actual Ten Commandments, you know, that's likely to have repercussions, you know.
Written by the finger of God on Mount Sinai.
There you go, if you believe in that sort of thing.
If you believe in that sort of thing.
And so this is really a far more compelling idea than Phil's electrical arc notions. And as we're going to see, it gradually overcomes it. And if you look at the drafts, and there's five of them total, five Larry Kasdan scripts, each successive draft emphasizes the electrical aspect less and less, and it comes closer and closer to the biblical
version. It gradually
version.
Gets more orthodox yes. with each draft of the
right.
script.
The early drafts go from a pretty straight-up presentation of the von Däniken idea to gradually ambiguity. Mm. Yes, Nazis get fried by the Ark, and Belloc dies believing he's seen the face of God. But maybe only in the same way that that Tesla did when he got electrocuted by one of his own generators once.
Interesting.
In other words, there's an ambiguity they're leaving in it on purpose. It's possible that they were inspired here by the way the Force is handled in Star Wars. You know, those that are so inclined can call it God if they want to. Other people can just put their own interpretation on it. Mm. So that may have been what they were thinking of in terms of making it ambiguous rather than a straight-up presentation of the Ark from outer space. But anyway, by the third draft, Kasdan's ready to include the following lines in his opening of the Ark scene at the end. Inside the Ark of the Covenant is God's reply to evil men. A pillar of fire rockets straight for the sky, turning night to day. In a blinding flash of whiteness, the entire island is ringed by a curtain of pure, streaking light. It is like the beginning of time, creation, that perfect moment when light was delivered to the planet. Those are lines from the third draft screenplay.
Three of five, we said.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But not even the fifth and final draft. In fact, the one they actually shot. Not even the fifth and final draft contains the appearance of the angels in it. And that's the one unmistakably, unambiguously religious element in the final movie.
I mean, you literally see angels of death hovering above the Nazis,
right.
raining down the wrath of God.
Right, right, right. Getting in their face and then melting them, you know. So, even this final draft of the script allows wiggle room for people that might prefer to interpret the Ark in some more mechanistic way, but not the finished movie. So if you're looking for the script where they put that stuff in, you don't ever find
exist.
It. It just gradually fades into what we see. We'll come back to this, but for the moment, let's take just a closer, take a minute to take a closer look at those destroying angels. Is this idea of avenging angels a biblical idea? Well, the short answer is yes.
I mean, pretty clearly, you know, I mean.
Exodus 12 says that God sent a, quote, destroyer to slay the firstborn in the final plague against Egypt. Psalm 78, which describes the same set of plagues, attributes them to, quote, destroying angels. Book of Job uses this same plural Hebrew word, which means messengers of destruction. The word angel, by the way, literally means a messenger in Hebrew. Proverbs 17:11 is interesting. It reads this way in many English translations. An evil man seeks only rebellion, and a cruel messenger will be sent against him. If you just read over that in English, you might not think anything, but the actual Hebrew reads, a merciless melech, a melech, M-E-L-A-C-H. It means a destroying angel. So there's a lot of this. 1 Chronicles 21:15, God sent an angel to Jerusalem to destroy it because of its unfaithfulness. King David intercedes, though, and, quote, the Lord repented of the evil, and he said to the destroying angel, it is enough, now stay your hand. So these beings are sentient. They can be communicated with. Interestingly, this isn't just a primitive Old Testament idea. It's in the Gospels, too. You remember in Matthew 13, Jesus says, talking about the end of time, he says, the Son of Man will send his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all evildoers and throw them into the furnace of fire. There men will weep and gnash their teeth. So the destroying angels are in the New Testament and in the mouth of Christ himself. So there's no question about it. St. John Chrysostom, a couple of centuries afterward, had this interesting comment. He said, notice Jesus' unspeakable love toward man and his disinclination to punishment. When he sows in his own person. But when he punishes, it is by others, that is, by the angels. So that's interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah.
As we noticed with the ark itself, some other sources shed some additional light. The Talmud pictures the death angel complaining about the loud laments of mourners at a funeral. What cause have you for such violent complaint? I am only the messenger of God and have done his bidding. And also, the Quran includes the idea that the angel of death is only doing God's will. As soon as he's received permission to destroy, however, he makes no distinction between good and bad.
Hmm.
Now, where do you think there's evidence for that in the Bible? You remember the Hebrew children at the Passover had to mark the doorways so that they wouldn't get wiped out along with
mark
everybody
it with
else.
The blood of a lamb.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly right. So
the houses of the children of Israel.
That's right. Which, by the way, leads us to another little topic that needs a word or two. How does Indy know to tell Marion not to look at the ark when it's open?
That's a really interesting point right there. See, they never address that.
Yeah. Actually, it's in a pretty early draft of the script.
Okay.
It's in the third draft. Yeah.
Okay.
I think the writers had 1 Samuel 6:19 in mind. You remember a couple of episodes back, we talked about how the Philistines took the ark and decided they didn't want it. They packed it into an ox cart and sent it back to Israel with good riddance.
Via singing oxes.
That's right. Yeah, that's another story from the Talmud. But the Hebrews who first discovered the ark when it was coming back into Israel, they lived at a place called Beth Shemesh. And most of them responded properly when the ark showed up. They set up an altar and they offered sacrifices of thanksgiving for its safe return. But some of the men of Beth Shemesh got curious, sort of like Pandora and her box.
Goodness gracious. The symbolism and the irony is insane.
So they knew that only ordained Levites were allowed to approach the ark, much less look inside of it. But their curiosity got the best of them and they peeked.
But of the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat.
Well, 1 Samuel 6:19 says, quote, the Lord slew some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked into the ark of the Lord. He slew 70 men of them, and the people mourned because the Lord had made a great slaughter among the people. End quote. So, wow. So Indy, who has been to Sunday school.
Yeah. As he now reveals by this line.
Warns Marion not to look. Now, I wish there was... Now, we might say, too, that most a good archaeologist, an archaeologist who deals with this kind of artifact, knows the Bible pretty well, usually. Even if he doesn't believe any of it. He knows it pretty backwards and forwards. So, it's possible
it's
that...
fair to say that...
Indy has acquired his Bible knowledge in that way also. But, of course, there are other reasons to think he's got a Christian background that we'll talk a little bit... Well, we talked a little about it in the first episode, but... I wish I could tell you that there's another set of story conference notes somewhere that tells us exactly who gave the order for these destroying angels, but there isn't one. All we know is that they aren't in the shooting script. I do think, my own theory, that it's probably Deborah Fine that's responsible for it, for don't look at it, Marion. In the transcript, she seems to have read everything that there is on the ark that is actually in the Bible. And also seems to have some level of real biblical. She's obviously not somebody that's very familiar with this or has got a deep background in either Judaism or Christianity, but she's done her work and as a researcher. And so she's read this story about the men of Beth Shemesh and probably included it in her research notes. She's not just guessing or remembering old Bible movies like Stephen is. She's done some homework. But she was already gone by the time shooting started, which was over 2 years later. So she can't be responsible for putting the angels in. She may very well have put in her research the idea that that these death angels are part of the lore. But if I were guessing, I'd say again that Steven Spielberg did it. And I'll tell you why. It's not just because he was the one that was most open to a supernatural explanation from the beginning, but because he really was the one that was most steeped in these 50s Bible movies. In Close Encounters, Roy Neary and his family are watching the Ten Commandments on TV. So
I'd forgotten about this. Yeah.
Actually, they're only watching five of the commandments.
That's fair enough. Yeah, but at any rate, point.
As we noted in the first episode of this series, the skeleton of Indy's conversion story is already present in that third draft of Kasdan's script. In fact, and this will be interesting, I'm not sure you've ever thought of this, the scene where Marcus, in Indy's apartment, where Indy describes Marcus's art concerns as a lot of hocus-pocus, superstitious hocus pocus. And you remember he ends the scene by tossing a big revolver into the suitcase as a way to express his approach to the boogeyman. You know, that scene, if you think about it, is almost an exact recapitulation of the scene in Star Wars where Han Solo ridicules the Force as a hokey religion.
Hokey religion.
Full of simple tricks and nonsense.
Yeah. And match for a good blaster at your side.
Right. It's almost exactly the same scene.
It's almost the same, yeah.
So really, subconsciously, we expect Indy to convert. That's what this scene is.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely...
Just like it is for Han Solo. We've seen Harrison Ford act out this scene and this character arc before.
Yeah. You know? We've seen this before, only 4 years earlier.
At
the time of Raiders.
70. This is 78.
Sure, for the writing, of course, yeah.
I think George probably intends Indy to be a guy like Han, who's seen a lot of strange things in the universe. But the experience that Indy has with the Ark here goes well beyond that. And making the Ark so ambiguous, especially by adding the angels, is what threw a monkey wrench into the works. You know, Indy blames the government men for not knowing what they've got there. Mm. But it invites the question, does Indy know?
Does he know?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, surely telling Marion not to look at it suggests that he does, or at least that that's the thing to act on at the moment, you know?
Yeah. It's fair to say that, I mean, he does close his eyes, so he doesn't actually see what occurs to destroy the Nazis. But after you know, after he opens his eyes and they find out what's happened, there's
that they're the only two people left alive on the island.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why the lines that ring so false, you know, needs to be researched and et cetera, are purely leftovers from the earlier version.
I never understood that particular line.
Yeah, it's got to be a leftover from the electrical arc idea. And that's an idea as we...
Probably good evidence that it was changed maybe as the movie was being made, you know. I mean, it's...
Maybe
it's not,
even while the special effects were being done.
Exactly,
which means principal photography was over.
Finished by that point, yeah.
Yeah, that may have been Steven Spielberg making that call when most of the movie was finished.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting, you know. I mean, this is an idea that didn't get changed until past the last minute.
Crazy.
Might even say there's a little bit of providential quality to
possibly,
it.
Possibly, yeah.
Miraculous even, maybe.
It makes you wonder, for sure.
That maybe God didn't want a cheesy flying saucer version of his Ark out there for millions of people to look at.
Yeah, well, I mean, he certainly didn't want those 70 men in the village to around with
that's
it.
Right.
I'll say that at least.
Well, what should be done with the Ark instead when they get it back to Washington?
Here we arrive at finally the question here. You have the Ark. It's destroyed your enemies. You've literally seen God come down and...
I'll tell you who got it right. Belloc.
I mean, Belloc is the only one that seems to actually believe in everything in the story.
If he believed the electrical version, the radio loudspeaker for talking to the flying saucer, he actually is speaking the truth. It should be used as originally intended, that is, as a radio for speaking to God, or better yet, for listening to God.
Yeah, there's a novel idea.
But that, I think, was a sequel that not even Larry Kasdan knew how to write.
Yeah.
Which is probably the reason that they made the sequel into a prequel. Not everybody notices, but Temple of Doom is supposed to be set in 35 rather than 36.
Yeah, we definitely see at the beginning of Raiders, it's South America 1936, right. And it's Shanghai, I believe. Shanghai, 1935, at the beginning of Temple of Doom.
Yeah, that's right. Now, in another important sense that maybe you haven't thought of, Indy really gets converted in every Indiana Jones movie. And thus, every Indiana Jones movie is really a remake of Raiders in disguise.
And there's your Bond influence right there.
Exactly.
That's something right there. That's the most Bond-like thing about Indy is they reset him at the beginning of every story.
Well, I mean, most James Bond movies are really thinly disguised remakes of Dr. No. So
I mean, yeah, you raise the point. Have we remade Dr. No 23 times or whatever it is at this point?
Right. here's some background on this. After Raiders was over, Larry Kasdan, who had just written two of the biggest movies of all time, Raiders of the Lost Ark and Empire Strikes Back, and would do Return of the Jedi, set out on his own at that point to become his own director. So Raiders is the only Indiana Jones film that he worked on. Without his influence, George, I think, was free to push Indy back into the 007 mode that was his original inspiration for the character. Which is why Indy starts off the Temple of Doom in a tux.
He's literally wearing the same tux that Sean Connery wears in From Russia with Love.
That's right. He sleeps with the heroine the first chance he gets, or he tries to anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting. By the time we get to the finished Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indy not only doesn't sleep with his admiring female students, as he did in early drafts, but he actually is uncomfortable. When they're batting their eyes at him and stuff, he's confused and uncomfortable. Mm. Very un-Bond-like.
Yes.
But of course, he's got this all sorted out by the by the next movie.
But, well, by the previous movie.
That's right.
That raises that question, you know.
So this is also why Temple of Doom, as you pointed out, is a standalone style adventure the way that the 007 movies are. Yeah. There's no continuing storyline through the 007 movies. There are a few little bits and bobs that get linked to earlier films, but
almost
not much.
As just a wink at the audience.
That's
though,
an
really.
In-joke. An inside joke.
For people who've seen all of them, you know.
You know, at it, this is the sort of story where everything has to be neatly back to where it was for the start of the next picture. It's just the type of series they're doing. It's like the original Star Trek. I love the original Star Trek, but each episode was self-contained.
Yeah.
So no matter how convincingly Dr. McCoy says, he's dead, Jim, you know he's not really dead.
Yeah.
Because you can't have, Mr. Spock can't die. He's got to be there in the next episode. Yeah.
Doesn't Scotty die in one episode and they bring him back?
I think a lot of them do. I think
yeah.
One of our readers will write in and tell us how many times the he's dead
he's
Jim
dead,
line
Jim.
Gets
yeah.
used. So yeah. anyway. But, yeah. And so this is what it is. I don't think George ever really imagined Indy as having any character arc any more than 007 has a character arc.
He had an idea for a guy in a situation.
And he had an idea.
Dilemma,
he had
know.
A kooky idea for a relic that he could go after.
But that was as far as George really had it planned.
And, right.
I mean, it's as much as I can tell, based on what he does with the other movies.
Yeah,
I mean,
he got more than he bargained for when they put the real arc into the movie.
Yeah.
In other words, that upped the ante in a very disruptive way. To a film series that George was thinking of from the very beginning in terms of a variation on James Bond.
The next Bond series,
James Bond,
yeah.
Right.
Bond in a fedora hat.
Right, exactly. So this is why that when Larry Kasdan came in and started deepening the character, remember he started out as a playboy, he started out as a fortune hunter, George even calls him a grave robber.
Outright calls him a grave robber earlier in the transcript, absolutely.
Kasdan, that doesn't make much sense to him, and Spielberg also. Also, Harrison Ford had an important part in all of this, too.
Okay, all
even
right.
while they were making the film, Harrison was changing the character slightly to make it more more like who he is, and the character we all know, and less like James Bond. So,
everyone could see that just the straight, pure, cynical grave robber that steals and seeks relics for his own fortune and glory, as they actually call it
right.
later. I mean, just wasn't going to work
well,
in this kind of movie.
Everybody, except the people who were still stuck on the 007 idea.
Yeah.
You know. So, anyway, Kasdan turned this fortune hunter into a devotee, what they used to call an enthusiast, a fanatic, really. That third draft has got those lines about archaeology is our religion, though we have both fallen from the purer faith. And also, well, I mean, it's clear that Kasdan's Indy is as obsessed with the Ark as Hitler is, maybe more so.
Yeah. Belloc certainly is more obsessed than Hitler
that's
is.
That's right, I mean, yeah. You know, Indy tells Marcus, that thing represents everything you and I got into archaeology for in the first place. So this is a very personal thing to him. And the way that Kasdan writes the script, Indy is persistence and enthusiasm personified. You know, if they put him in a tomb, he knocks his way out of it. If they put the Ark into a truck, Indy gets a horse.
Yep.
If they load it onto a submarine, he straps himself to the periscope, you know.
Yep.
I mean, the guy will not give up, you know.
Yeah.
He won't allow himself to get further than a couple of hundred yards from the Ark if he can help it.
Indy, if you still want the Ark, it has been loaded onto a truck.
What truck? That's right. And then, of course, there's that other line. This guy never gives up, does he?
Yep.
And that's a real key to Indiana Jones is that...
when Belloc sees the explosion, I'm pretty sure he's doomed Indy to his death.
Right, right.
Jones.
That's right. So he knows his man. He knows his man.
He knows that Indy isn't going to give up for anything.
I think this is a super interesting aspect of the character, the way in which... The real key to making the character work was to make him totally selfless. He's not interested in the babes. Mm-mm. He might on another occasion be, but he's not interested in the babes. So long as the Ark is there, He's not interested in fortune and glory. He's not interested in women. He's not interested in money. He's not even interested. He's not really thinking about Adolf Hitler very much.
Yeah, that's the other thing. That's where we get. Yeah,
like, that's right.
He's not really even specifically doing it to keep the ark away from Hitler.
Right. This is his religion in not exactly the right sense, but still.
Okay. Yeah, it's definitely another aspect. You can see the versions of...
Keep in mind, this is a guy who has fallen from the purer faith. In other words, he's got a background in this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting. Have you ever heard the story that's kind of floating around about Indy's alleged failure? I think it got started in a sitcom a few years back. There's a scene in one of these sitcoms where the characters... are kicking around this idea that, oh, did you ever notice, did you ever realize that Indiana Jones always fails?
He never succeeds in acquiring any of the artifacts.
More than that, he never even affects the outcome of the story in any real significant way.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't succeed in what he's trying to do. The villains get what they came for, all the rest of it. And the guy gets saved in every film by the ultimate no-no, as far as the screenwriter is concerned, the Deus Ex Machina, the God and the machine. You know, you pull the God step in and save the guy at the last minute.
The hand of God.
That's right. Well, you know, Indy gets bailed out by God or the gods, however you want to look at that.
What have you?
Right. And so this is according to the story, this is an odd, curious thing. Hadn't you ever thought about the fact that Indy never really achieves anything in any of his movies? Actually, this is a very foolish, imperceptive notion. And it shows how completely they're missing the point. Yes, the gods do step in, but they do it for a definite reason. They do it not because Indy has failed, but to reward Indy for having been willing to fail. This is a really significant idea. Excuse me. In spite of what I said about his stick-to-itiveness, Indy's number one virtue isn't really determination or courage.
Daring.
Odd as this may sound, his number one virtue is piety.
It's really interesting.
The virtue of piety, this is the textbook definition. Piety is a form of justice. It means giving to everything its proper due. Okay, that's the root word of it. Piety means treating holy things with the reverence, devotion, and careful regard that they actually deserve. So, Indy may or may not know exactly where he stands as far as God, but he does know that Coronado's cross belongs in a museum.
Absolutely.
That's right. And not in the hand of some guy who wants to sell it for a bunch of money.
Yeah.
A grave robber and a fortune hunter. Mm-hmm. Okay. In every movie, we see holy things in danger of falling into the hands of unworthy men to be used for unworthy purposes. And in every movie, Indy undertakes to prevent this from happening.
Mm-hmm.
He strives, he struggles, he suffers. He puts his life on the line to prevent it from happening. And yes, he fails also in every film.
In every film.
Right. But the gods, who've been watching from above, have seen his piety, and they step in to reward him for it.
Mm-hmm.
By destroying his enemies, who, of course, have sinned through impiety.
Interesting.
It's actually a very old story. Some version of it's present in just about every form of folklore or mythology or religion, which is probably how it got into this story. I'm not sure any of the filmmakers consciously thought of it, but the hero who gets saved at the last minute by a supernatural intervention because he was a pious man. Mm-hmm. It's not a flaw. Yes, there's the deus ex machina, literally, but it's not a flaw.
That's the twist. It is deus ex machina.
Yeah,
the
really,
point of the story is that.
That's really, it's the heart of every Indiana Jones movie. And all of this is why I don't really think Indy can ever really convert. I think he's just doomed to convert over and over again in every movie.
Yeah.
Because that's what he does, you know. Mm. Now,
at this point.
Yes. You know, I mean, it is true that, and there's various other ways that the long shadow of 007 has messed with our ability to take the three or four films as any sort of one continuous story. Mm. You know, I think that's the number one thing that's gummed up the works is the long shadow of James Bond. But Temple of Doom wasn't very well received, as most of you know. So the third movie is a bit of an apology for it. And as a result, is much more like the first Indiana Jones and hits most of the same marks. But like we said, that's another story for another day. But
not to mention Crystal Skull, which seems to go back to Von Däniken almost.
Yes, it does. Yeah, but like we said, that's another story for another
topic for another day.
But yes, I hope that we have successfully communicated our love for these movies, in spite of the fact that we have to say that in one or two ways they're a little bit short of the mark, one or two areas,
mm-hmm.
Which I think probably is something that most of y'all agree with too, in various ways that not all of them are the masterpieces that they could have been.
Few movies are, though.
Raiders caught lightning in a bottle. I mean, the same filmmakers, essentially, with mm-hmm. a few exceptions, made the other films too.
Yep.
I think you may remember that when we first started this podcast, I said that I won't waste time talking about movies that I don't like on mm-hmm. some level. I don't like all of them to the same degree. In fact, I have my own personal formula where the Indiana Jones movies are concerned. I think that by some mysterious algebra, each successive Indiana Jones movie is exactly half as good as the previous one.
A proper universal algorithm that can be...
Right. My own perspective, of course. But
as you say, I mean...
Since Raiders is so marvelous, even a movie 1/16th as good as Raiders is still worth watching.
Still worth seeing, definitely.
So, at any rate, hopefully, if we've achieved nothing else in 6 hours of Indiana Jones, you guys can maybe have an urge right now to get out your DVD or Blu-ray and...
put in good old Raiders.
Put in Raiders of the Lost Ark, one of the most perfect movies ever done. And... a thing of beauty and a joy forever.
Oh, yeah.
So I give thanks to God for the movie, for the experience, for saving us from the electrical arc.
Yeah, definitely.
And
I think that's the thing we can all take away from this.
Right.
That, like, literally, like, thank God. I mean,
that's right.
That we didn't get the it's not aliens, but it's aliens version certainly looked doomed to be
absolutely
to have it early on.
And I also thank God for you, our listeners. We're actually doing pretty well as far as the number of downloads. I do wish that more of you would go to Facebook and look up the Popcorn Cathedral group and send us a joining request, because it'd be great to get more feedback. Mm-hmm. All of this stuff is fun, but and there's 375 of you downloading each episode so far. So somebody's listening. So,
we want to hear what you guys think.
It'd be nice to talk to you a little bit. So, please, if you're on Facebook at all, shoot us a friend request for the Popcorn Cathedral Facebook group,
and hit us up for some Indiana Jones discussion. Hopefully, too.
Next week, we're going to do one single standalone episode, which I'm just calling an MCU roundup.
Yeah, we're just going to go back to Marvel for a while here.
We've talked for 6 hours about a 40-year-old movie. Let's talk about something new for a while.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get more younger people to listen. So there's various things we can talk about as regarding the MCU. There have been some new developments lately and also some interesting things that Jack and I have parsed out from the story that my sister told me about the Christmas party at Pinewood, Atlanta. And things that tell us something about the Avengers 3 and 4. So maybe that will tease you enough to come back next week.
Which, another reason we have God to thank as well, we're getting Infinity War a week early.
That's right.
May 4th has been updated to April 27th.
Pretty good.
Super happy about that.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, next week, MCU Roundup with Jack and Ron. And be there or be around us. See you then.
Thank you.
How many people we could help, and how good you feel after you've helped others.
I know Lent is about giving, so I want to give.
Especially these kids are talking about CRS Rice Bowl, a Lenten program known by generations of Catholic families.
But how do
children love it because they experience different cultures and gain a lasting impression of people they are helping? You can bring CRS Rice Bowl into your home and experience the joy of seeing your children or grandchildren find new meaning in Lent. Visit CRSRiceBowl.org to get started.
Rice Bowl inspired me to pray more and pray for those who are less fortunate.
/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
I learned how many people we could help and how good you feel after you've helped others.
I know Lent is about giving, so I want to give.
These kids are talking about CRS Rice Bowl, a Lenten program known by generations of Catholic families. Children love it because they experience different cultures and gain a lasting impression of the people they are helping. You can bring CRS Rice Bowl into your home and experience the joy of seeing your children or grandchildren find new meaning in Lent. Visit CRS Rice Bowl.org to get started.
Rice Bowl inspired me to pray more and to pray for those who are less fortunate.
The big Cincinnati Catholic Men's Conference is back. Tickets are on sale now for Saturday, April 28th at the Taft Theater at CincinnatiMen'sConference.com or call 513-214-1534. Don't miss the incredible day of Motivation. Roster is being hailed as one of the best lineups in the country.
Men from all
in
walks
rare appearances. Come get see tickets Father now Mitch at CincinnatiMen'sConference.com. Or call
Motivator Father Larry Richards,
214,
former Moeller High School and University of Notre Dame
Cincinnati
head
Men's
football
Conference
coach
com,
Jerry Faust,
or
513
big celebrity 214
Baz Rutten,
UFC
Thank
World
you
Champion,
for listening to Breadbox
MMA
Media.
World
Find
Champ,
more about
and
us
movie star.
At BreadboxMedia.com.
The conference theme is what it means to be a true Christian man in today's society. Don't miss the incredible day of motivation, spiritual benefit, and fellowship with men from all walks of life. Get tickets now at CincinnatiMen'sConference.com or call 513-214-1534. That's CincinnatiMen'sConference.com or 513-214-1534. Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at BreadboxMedia.com.